Mike Leonard, our federal defense attorney on call, joins us now. Hey, Mike, how are you?
How are you doing, buddy? It's been a while, it feels like.
I know. I don't think we've had you on the show for a couple weeks, which is pretty rare. And that might have been on the phone, too. So I haven't seen you in person and gotten to pay off on that sandwich you owe me.
Yeah, I apologize for the steep drop in your ratings, but I'm trying to see if I can, you know, revive them this week, John. I don't know about this time period, this time slot. Is it better or is it worse?
Well, it's after dark, so we can be a little looser on this, Mike.
Oh, but I look outside and I still see the sun, buddy. So is it really after dark?
Okay, well, the sun will set during the program. Let's not get down to semantics here, Mike. I guess you are a lawyer, and that's what your entire career is built on.
Yes, I can defend the sun. I can defend, you know, a defendant. So, are you going to start with the Taylor Swift legal news, or where do you want to start?
There's Taylor Swift legal news?
Yeah, there's a big battle over whether she would be required to appear for a deposition in the Blake Lively-Baldoni sexual harassment case going on in New York.
I don't know anything about the words you just said, so please set it up for me and the rest of the listeners. Celebrity stuff is not my thing, Mike, so wind this back and give it to me.
You should read People Magazine and Us Weekly, like, each month to see what's going on. But you don't even know that the actress Blake Lively, who was filming a movie with a guy named Justin Baldoni, who was the director, you don't know there's a lawsuit going on between the two of them?
I don't know who Blake Lively is, Mike. This is what we're talking about.
Yeah, she's a famous actress. Hopefully the listeners will browbeat you by text and say, John, get out of your cave. But in any event, she's a pretty famous actress, and she's married to Ryan Reynolds, who is another famous person. Do you know who that is?
I do know who Ryan Reynolds is, yes. Kind of.
They're married. And so Blake Lively was filming a movie, and this guy, Justin Baldoni, was the director, and a big lawsuit erupted out of it where she said he was sexually harassing her, and he countersued her for defamation. And so if you read the celebrity tabloids, which I know you don't now, John, you'd see that they talk all about this. But Taylor Swift came into the focus of the case because one of the parties said they wanted to take her deposition. And, of course, you can't just take anyone's deposition. There has to be some relevance to the case. And it sounds like the judge is likely not going to find it relevant enough to force her to appear for a deposition.
Why would he? What is the connection? What was the argument they were making for why they wanted Taylor Swift deposed?
Well, I guess Baldoni, who's one of the parties, argued that she was in attendance at a meeting with Blake Lively during the shooting of the movie, and somehow that will be relevant to the dispute.
I wonder, like, if she had to appear for a deposition, is everything public? Would it be live, or do they tape these things on video and then present evidence in court? How does that work? What are people's rights when they are deposed?
That is a great question. Yeah, so they're never public at the time. The only people who are allowed to attend is the attorneys, and then if it's a company, the company could have, let's say, a representative there as well. But typically it's just the attorneys, the person being deposed, the court reporter, you know, and it might be a representative of a party or parties. But no, it would never be allowed to be public. So it's, you know, it basically takes place like you sometimes see on TV in a conference room. Not always as exciting as you see on TV. And a lot of times they're videotaped. And why are they videotaped? So that you can use them at trial if need be. And, attorneys would think it's more effective. First of all, if the witness isn't available to testify at trial, who's given a deposition. So sometimes you can actually use that videotape or that transcript in place of it. So it'd be more effective to have the actual video to show to the jury. And then in terms of it being released publicly, yes and no. Sometimes they are released publicly. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes you need to file a motion in court. You'll attach the transcript or portions of it so it becomes public, or sometimes they're just leaked out. But there's no, you know, general public right to the deposition transcripts.
Yeah, I find that, a reason why people wouldn't want to be deposed, right? They don't, especially if it's like loosely related to the case, because what scope of questions can you be asked about? I would imagine the same level of threshold exists there, that the attorneys can only ask you questions as it relates to the case at hand, right?
Sure, but as you can imagine, there's a lot of other questions that we ask. So that's why people don't like having a deposition taken, because they feel like their life is being pried into, and they have this sense, the attorney's asking me about all these personal things. They're asking me about my work history. They're asking me about my relationship with the person who's a party to the case. You know, it seems like they're digging into my life. So that's why people feel uncomfortable, because at any deposition, even though, the questions that are going to be used are ones that are material to the case and the facts of the case, but The attorney has pretty broad range to ask you questions because they get to ask you about your background. So they would start with you, John. They'd be like, okay, you know, tell me about where you went to high school. Where'd you go to college? Do you have any training after that? They'd go through your whole work history. Then they'd ask questions to try to establish your relationship to the parties in the case. You know, how often do you see Miss Jones, Mr. Hansen? Have you ever been to her house? How many times? Do you go out to clubs together? You know, all these kind of questions, which are all fair game because they're trying to show, number one, your background, but then number two, your bias towards someone in the case. So it can be very uncomfortable being deposed in a case, you know, regardless of what the case is about.
Yeah, I also wonder, and I know that you're under oath during that portion of the deposition, right?
Oh, sure. And if you remember famously,
Bill Clinton
being deposed, and then that transcript getting out in the public and how silly that made him look. But, you know, the typical case, the transcript's never going to see the light of day, and no one's going to ever care. But oftentimes they are on the public record because they're filed on the docket as part of a motion or something like that. So you can have all sorts of information out there in the docket about you that you think is a little bit weird and uncomfortably out there in the public domain. But I know you're just about to ask, well, can you take depositions of people in criminal cases? I know you were just about to go there, right?
Oh, actually, Mike, when you started talking about it, I was like, we should remind people we're talking about a civil case. Depositions, are they more fact-finding in a criminal case, or is there any such mechanism that's similar to a deposition?
John, that's an excellent question. So they're very rare. So there has to be a situation where, sometimes like in death penalty cases are allowed, but in general they're not allowed. And so you'd have to make a substantial showing as to why you're allowed to take that deposition. So for instance, in federal court, we dealt with this issue within the last year where if you have a witness who's going to be unavailable, let's say they live in another country, and so you can't compel them to come to the trial, or they're elderly and they might die or they might become infirm, you can actually, in unique circumstances, get approval to take that deposition so you can preserve the testimony and use it at a trial. But in general, in criminal cases, you can't take depositions. And that's why a lot of lawyers hate civil practice. They only want to do criminal because they hate this whole thing of all these depositions and all this paper exchange and all that sort of stuff. So they want no part of civil cases.
Well, I know you do both, but I know you love the courtroom way more than the conference room.
I do, but the conference room, it's fun too. I mean, I always tell like lawyers I'm working with and who are working for me, it's a great chance to get a great experience cross-examining people, and you're doing it, you know, from 3 feet away. And so it still requires the same preparation. It still requires the same sort of techniques, particularly if the deposition is going to be used at a civil trial. So you do use all those techniques and skills, and it's great practice with a lot less pressure. You know, there's no judge, there's no jury. If you ask a stupid question, it's okay. You know, you're not going to look stupid in front of a jury or a judge. So, you know, it's a great way to learn, to be honest with you, for young attorneys, I feel like.
Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney here. You mentioned that one area where you could use depositions in a criminal case. Did I hear you right? For death penalty cases, what mechanism would a deposition play in something like that?
It's a good question because I've never handled one, but I do have a vague understanding in the back of my mind that are sometimes allowed in those cases. So I don't know the direct answer to that.
That's okay. Well, you actually answered my next question. I wondered, as a federal defense attorney, I know there's certain crimes federally that are punishable by death. I'm kind of speaking out of turn, but I think that's correct based on episodes of The West Wing I've seen. You also do state cases, and obviously Illinois doesn't have the death penalty now, but you've never worked a death penalty case then?
I haven't. I think it would be really fascinating to do it, especially from the mitigation standpoint. You know, so that's what so much goes into it, is that you know, not only for the trial, but also for sentencing purpose, you're really taking a huge deep dive in a person's life and trying to really uncover all mitigating circumstances, particularly if you go to the penalty phase, you know, the death penalty phase, because you're, of course, you know, trying to put before the court, you know, the life story of the person and all the mitigating circumstances that makes them the person they are. So I think that'll be really interesting to do.
Yeah, and we're going to have to kind of have this conversation. You know, maybe this week is not the appropriate time to really bring this up, but I know that the Utah governor has said that he absolutely will want to seek the death penalty for the alleged shooter of Charlie Kirk, the horrific shooting of a 31-year-old who started Turning Point USA and has been very influential in conservative politics for the past decade or so, even at such a young age. this is going to come into the national conversation, perhaps on like cases. I mean, Micah, it's weird to say this, but a lot of these shooters who end up doing this are die of a self-inflicted wound, right? And this is not the case here. So this is going to end up, I don't know if it's going to spark a national conversation on the death penalty, but it certainly will be a high-profile case that will be followed.
Oh, I think you're exactly right. I think that's already started. I feel like this week already, I've heard more death penalty talk, more death penalty news on the internet than ever, because, of course, they're talking about that. And the governor of Utah has said, yeah, we're going to seek the death penalty in the case, which is really the prosecutor's decision, but he's trying to get out there.
Right.
Which, you know, I understand in a state like a state that has the penalty, they would say that. Illinois abolished it, you know, per Governor Ryan years ago. But I think it's really going to revive talk of that. I don't know that, you know, it would be a great discussion for your show, probably not tonight, but sometime, because it really brings out all sorts of arguments on all sides, you know, from deterrence to, you know, retribution, all sorts of different arguments that people have. And, you know, from all different walks of life, all different views on that issue and whether it's appropriate or not. So I think that'll be a good subject for us someday.
Yeah, I know. And it doesn't feel quite right to really dive deep into it today, but for another day.
Yeah.
But it's one of those issues where I have oscillated many times on, and I also have never gotten so up about it. I guess if you were to ask me, do I oppose or support the death penalty? I think my first gut reaction would say oppose. But if you ask me, you scale a 1 to 10, how much do you care about it? I'd say like a 2 or a 3. It's not an issue that gets me all riled up.
Yeah, it's an interesting issue because I feel like when I was in law school or just out, I don't know why, it seemed like there was much more talk about it. Maybe because since we're in Illinois and at that time they had it, every time they used it was extremely controversial. I mean, not necessarily like the Gacy case, I don't think. It was this controversial in that case, but there's other cases where it was very controversial. And then over the years going forward with wrongful convictions and, you know, the advances in technology and evidence where we saw people wrongfully convicted and wrongfully executed, then it became a bigger story. But I feel like that issue, the death penalty issue, has been a little bit dormant for the last 5 or 10 years, don't you?
I agree. I there's not very many conversations on it. And I wonder if other people feel the same way as me. It's also that oscillation I mentioned, because I think it's really easy to come up with an example. Well, what about this person? And you say that to someone who's opposed, and it's really hard to defend your opposition to the death penalty when presented with a John Wayne Gacy or a Terry McVeigh situation, right?
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, there's strong arguments for and against it. There's no question about it. And I think it's
Timothy McVeigh.
It is very fact specific, you know, and that's the problem. And then, you know, when you have these cases in some states where they use it all the time, and then you find out that there's a lot of wrongful convictions arising out of it, it's really troublesome.
Yeah, I think that's ultimately what leads me to the opposing side, is that there have been people that have been wrongfully put to death in the past, and if that's something you can avoid, don't do it. But I also am not someone who has had someone close to me murdered. And I know we don't distribute justice based on the emotions of people that knew the victims, but I'm not someone that's been in that position, and I can't feel what those people feel in that case. And yeah, I don't know if it's a deterrent at all. I don't think so. But does it bring some peace to the people that are suffering the most? And if ultimately I don't care all that much, then yeah, see, here I go again, Mike.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting too, because when you think about the life without possibility of parole and some of the places that people are housed who have that sentence, like these supermax facilities, where they're literally never out of their cell. Like, for instance, you know, electronic gate allows them to go out to go to the shower and to come back, and they never have any human contact. I mean, I could argue that that is a harsher punishment. You know, if you have that for the rest of your life,
yeah, maybe
being killed is a harsher punishment. Of course, we're not people who have, you know, murder victims, and we're not their family members to speak to that, you know.
And as Mike Leonard reminded me just a few minutes ago, federal defense attorney, I can't say it's after dark because the sun sets not till 7:02. So this is Let's Get Legal pre-dark. Does that work for you, Mike?
That works. That's effective, John. We'll say overruled.
Okay. We got a text from the 847 from someone I appreciate, because you know, we say a lot of words, and I've been on for 4 hours now in a row. Still got an hour 20 to go. So sometimes words come out of my mouth that sound right in my head, seem right in my head, but they don't make their way out when we speak this much without scripts. And I don't know if I'm right or wrong or the texter is, Mike, so you need to help me out, okay?
Okay. You don't get paid by the word, John, because if you do, you're getting well paid.
Yeah. No, I'm not like Dickens, who literally got paid by the word as a writer. And you can tell by some of his books. And I love him as a writer. But 847 says, love you, John, and I have respect for what you do. But I keep using the term oscillate when I think you mean vacillate. And I was talking about the death penalty. And vacillating, I do know, means to kind of waver between opinions, which would certainly be a correct way of using it. I guess when I use the word oscillate, I'm trying to like show wide pendulum swings. But I don't know, Mike, can I use oscillate when I'm talking about an opinion of something?
I think you can't. I think that means like it's I picture oscillate as like pushing out power, like throbbing or something like that, versus vacillate going back and forth. That's my layperson's view.
So you think the texter's right, I should be saying vacillate?
Yes, I'm going with the texter, you know, over you. Of course, I'm going to do that anyway, but I think the texter's right on.
Yeah, maybe. Sometimes I also say, which people always text about, hey, I want to marinate on this topic a little bit more. And I forget what suggestion. Oh, I think they say you should say ruminate. And I'm saying marinate like I'm letting the thought fester and soak in the juices. What do you think about marinate versus the other word that I use that I've already forgotten?
I'd say wrong again. You know,
okay. I think you want ruminate instead of marinate.
If you use the language a little different. If you said, I want to let my opinion marinate, then maybe, but you can't marinate, but you can ruminate. Oh. That's what Brother Rule from St. Vider High School would have said back in the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. The way you said that, right. I want us to ruminate on the, or, you know, I got to stop at this point. I can just hear the radios clicking off. All right, Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney. Let me know, the texters, where I stand on this. 312-981-7200. You were right. We never really did close the loop on some Menendez brothers news that you and I and Patrick Dolan had talked about for weeks when all those shows were coming out about them. And then we were waiting and we thought, these guys are going to get out, we think. What is the latest on this? Not so much?
Yeah, so it's weird how those stories take on a life of their own, become the biggest hot sensation all over the internet and all over TV, and then they go away. What happened was the prosecutor's office in L.A. did recommend to the court that they change the sentence, reduce it from life without possibility of parole to 50 years to life, which the purpose of that was to make them eligible for parole. So then the parole issue was decided about a month ago, where they both had parole hearings. And both were denied parole, which was very interesting. I think a lot of the public thought they were going to get released, and they weren't. So for right now, the story's dead. And I think, I don't know when they're up for parole again out there in California, but it was basically the door was opened and then it was shut.
Yeah. So it's a still standing period, but essentially this is not good for them?
Well, of course not good. I mean, they don't have any remedy. So
Whenever
California lets them come up for parole review again, they'll get another chance. They'll get another bite at the apple. But the judge did what the judge could by reducing the sentence, which made them parole eligible. But then that went to the parole board, who said no. So they don't have any remedy in court, unless, you know, I think there was talk of trying to file some kind of motion or trying to reopen the case based on newly discovered evidence. So I don't know if that's going anywhere. But basically, right now they're stuck in their cells.
Well, that would require the prosecutor's office to do something, correct?
Well, no. I mean, they could file. I don't know if they're still eligible. They might have already filed and exhausted all their remedies. But one of the things they were talking about when this issue came up was that they had what they called newly discovered evidence. But I think that newly discovered evidence was simply used at the hearing, which was used to reduce their sentence and change their sentence. So I don't know if they still have a legal remedy where they can argue, hey, we got this newly discovered evidence, you know, take a look at our case again, court. I don't know if that still exists. But that would be the only possible way at this point they'd have any other avenue to get relief, to get out, other than parole.
Yeah, it was a fascinating couple of documentaries that were made about the Menendez brothers and opening up some new angles to the conversation.
Yeah, where did you sort of come? I think I watched both of them. There was a lot of footage. I mean, it was really interesting watching the footage from back then.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like you're watching a time capsule. Where did you come out on it, like, after looking at it? What did you think?
Oh, I definitely felt like there was a more complex situation that led to the killing than I had previously understood as a young person when that all happened. And if you're just joining us, or you don't know what the heck we're talking about, the Menendez brothers, who killed their parents pretty famously, and it was painted as they were doing it for the money. They did spend lavishly, which certainly doesn't help their cause of what they were chatting about or what they argued. Years later, it's kind of come out more that the father was abusive, sexually abusive to the brothers, and that could have created an environment where it made it a little bit more understandable why they do what they do. I think what always struck me, Mike, is they killed their mom too, and that has always stuck with me. And I know there's arguments for her being a part of the abuse, or at least allowing it, but that always seemed to go to another level. And like, I think she tried to crawl away, and you know, I don't know. It took it to a different point.
To me, you know, even watching the documentaries and the real story or the Hollywood version, like to me, that's just the unconscionable part. You know, basically blew their mother away, and their post explanation seemed to be like not because she was so complicit. It was the fact that, well, she would have a hard time living without
what's
going on.
Which, like, no.
So to me. That's what makes it so unconscionable. I mean, you can talk about release and punishment being too long, but I can see why, in light of that, you know, people could say, no way, you know, they shouldn't get the reduction.
I think that's where I landed on that one. I'm not vacillating on this opinion, Mike, to be sure.
I'm glad you're not oscillating either. I know we no longer will be after getting admonished by the viewer.
I'm just surprised, as a defense attorney, you're not buying the defense's argument there.
It was just hard. I mean, you know, anyone's mother to do that to anyone's mother, it's hard to accept, especially when the explanation they gave is just, to me, horrific, too. So, I had a hard time coming down on their side. So,
I will say two things can be true, though. I think it was important to have a conversation, and it is important to recognize that abuse, sexual abuse, happens to both young men and young women. I don't want to say equally, but it happens to both. And I think now we are way better at identifying that as troublesome and potentially a trigger for actions. And I'm glad that that's a better part of the conversation than it used to be.
Oh yeah, I think that's huge, and I think that's great that they got back in the public domain. It was kind of alarming surprising, I guess, to me, to learn that in the 80s, early 80s, that the idea that only a female could be sexually exploited, abused, was the idea. Like, and that was said in court by the prosecutor as if it was impossible, which is just hard. You know, we know so much more now, but even think that
even
in the
80s, then,
people
though,
thought that. Yeah, that's why it's so surprising to me. Yeah.
Federal defense attorney Mike Leonard joining us. And Mike, I'm sure you don't want a defense attorney to lose their gig. What do you think about someone representing themselves at trial, like we have in a pretty prominent case?
Well, instead of hiring me, that's just a horrible decision. You know, maybe financial reasons, you know, but what a bad choice. No, the famous line, John, is a client or a lawyer who has a client as himself. Wait, how's it go? A lawyer? I'm losing the famous line about representing yourself. A lawyer, a client, I know. I'll come up with it.
Okay, you'll figure it out, yeah.
It's a good quote. It's a horrible idea, first of all. But, I mean, it's happened in a lot of, not a lot, but a number of high-profile cases over the years, usually with sort of people who are, you know, megalomanias like the Ted Bundys and people like that. But in the one of the Trump cases where a person tried to shoot him from a golf, you know, when he was playing golf, you remember that case?
The second assassination attempt, yeah.
Yeah, his last name is Routh, I believe, Routh, and that case is going on right now in federal court in Florida, and he's representing himself, which it makes absolutely no sense. Usually there's two reasons. Either there's a mental health problem or they have some sort of, you know, ego complex.
Megalomaniac, yeah.
Yeah. So that's what's actually happening now, and from the press reports, the head opening statements, and the Ralph guy who was trying to give like his own opening statement and was just making no sense, was talking about things that have nothing to do with anything, and the judge, you know, shut him down, which as they should. I do have a great recent story, though, how, you know, in 2024, I think it was, we had someone approach us. They had a federal case. The charge was assault of a federal officer. What they were basically charged with was spitting at an FBI agent. Okay,
and spitting at an FBI agent. Okay.
Yeah, and they got charged. I thought, you know, I don't want to get into all the circumstances, but I thought it was a very unfair charge and an unfair case, and like, why are we doing this? So this client comes to us and says, you know, he wants us to represent him. We said yes, and And then, you know, I can't get any attorney-client things, but, you know, this is public on the docket. For reasons that we disagreement over different motions to file, we said, okay, we want to withdraw. The court said you can withdraw. So we expected, of course, you know, he'd have a new lawyer would take over. And so I just got a curiosity, looked at the docket, and the guy went to trial, had no lawyer, and won, got the not guilty in federal court.
Whoa!
Against essentially the federal prosecutors and the FBI. I thought it was remarkable.
Wait. He actually got a not guilty? You have told us how rare a not guilty in federal court is.
Yeah, and he got it. I was like, oh, that is a great story, which should be covered by somebody.
Well, you should have called me. I mean, I guess we're doing it right now, so.
Yeah, well, I learned about it months after the fact. I just out of curiosity, I'm like, whatever happened in that case? So I looked at the docket, and I see the days it went to trial. It was like a two-dayer. And I see the not guilty verdict, so hats off to our
Did you think
client.
It was a really, yeah. did you think it was?
If Boston, they get the not guilty, John. You know, yeah. That's probably a bad omen. I shouldn't be putting that out there.
Did you think it was a really strong case?
Yeah, our position was, yeah, this is very defensible. First of all, we thought it was very unfair and very defensible and definitely winnable. So I'm glad that he won. And, you know, maybe I shouldn't be advertising that someone didn't use this one to try by himself and won, but I'm telling you the truth, John.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I know you're just bummed out about missing out on the money and the fame.
Yeah, exactly.
You were like, oh, that's a slam dunk. I get to add to my list of not guilty verdicts by the feds.
Exactly. You saw right through me there.
A lawyer who represents himself has a fool.
Has a client for a fool. A client for a fool. Fool as a client?
Yeah, a fool for a client.
Can you read it one more time?
I sure can. A lawyer who represents himself has a fool for a client.
Yep, that's the famous line. You know,
it's attributed to Lincoln, but it wasn't Lincoln. So,
yeah. Interesting. I spent some time in Lincoln territory. We had a trial down in Springfield, and it is kind of cool how everywhere you go, there's a Lincoln picture. There's Lincoln set. I mean, like in the courthouse, everywhere in the hotel, it's just kind of cool because you don't see that in Chicago so much.
No, and they do a really good job recreating like that block. They have like a whole little area that looks like it did in Lincoln's time. It's cool.
Oh, yeah. I definitely enjoyed it. Hadn't been down there in a long time.
What else you got coming up? Are you a busy guy these days? I'm sure. I know you got a lot of trials.
Yeah. As I sit here right now, I have a case that is not done where a jury started deliberating, and they'll continue to deliberate next week. So, that's definitely on my mind. it was a week longer, and he did closing arguments Friday. So, you know, it's like kind of like I can breathe again. And then we had a trial a couple weeks before that, and we got some upcoming. So, kind of trial, take a break type of situation right now.
And when you get to trial, you've already done countless hours of work in pretrial motions, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just a ton that goes into a pretrial, especially in federal court. We have to file all these different things, different motions at different times, and a lot of hearings leading up to the trial. And then, of course, just preparing all your cross-examinations and your opening statement and your closing argument. So, yeah, just a ton of time.
It seems exhausting. Like, I don't know how anyone does more than one trial a year, like the prep for it and then the actual trial. Like, how big of a team do you have at Leonard Trial Lawyers?
We have as many as we need. No. Sometimes we try them with two lawyers. Sometimes we actually try them with another firm together. You know, it just depends on the situation. Sometimes by yourself.
But you have, like, assistants and paralegals, right?
Oh, yeah. But, you know, of course, they're instrumental. But, you know, it's also sometimes a strategic decision. You know, how many lawyers are you going to have sitting at the table at trial, whether it's good to have one, whether it's good to have two, whether it's good to have male and female, male.
Whoa, that's a part of the conversation?
Of course, yeah. I mean, you gotta think about that. I mean, I think that sometimes it's a mistake, first of all, to have, you know, two, three, four lawyers at
a
the
team,
table.
Yeah.
I just don't think that's a good look sometimes. Depends on the case.
Let me take a guess. Let me play this out in my head and see if you agree. If I am in a trial for a white collar crime, I don't want to make it look like I'm super rich and have five lawyers at the table with me. That will make me seem unsympathetic and like, yeah, this guy is finding any way he can to be rich and try and buy himself off.
Yeah, there's definitely a school of thought that says that, and then there's definitely a school of thought that goes the other way, that you know, it's sort of a fair fight. The government's going to have, you know, at least two lawyers, maybe sometimes more, and they're going to have an FBI agent or Homeland Security agent sitting there at the table, and they're going to have this vast array of people helping them. So, you know, sometimes you give them the look that you have the same resources. It just depends, you know, on the case and how you think that's going to go over. So, yeah, but it's definitely a consideration.
People like underdogs. If the feds have four people at the table and you've got Mike Leonard, a giant figure in and of himself, I don't know. I feel like there's already this the man against the little guy.
Yeah, definitely. And sometimes that goes into your thought process. But, you know, sometimes it's not feasible. It's hard to do a case by yourself, particularly if it's a long case, because there's just so much that goes into it. And it's hard to do every examination yourself. Yeah. And sometimes strategically, that's not good to do every examination yourself. Sometimes they need a break
from you.
Your style or from you.
Yeah, that's why we haven't had you on. That was a couple of weeks why we didn't have you on, Mike. We needed a break.
Yeah.
15 seconds.
My wife was just shaking her head. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
What's your phone number if people need to reach you for their defense or any whistleblowing stuff they've got?
312-380-6559. Can I give a quick shout out?
Please, really quick.
Huge listening audience for you in Madison, Wisconsin at the Alpha Z Delta sorority. And then congrats to Molly Leonard and Travis Champer on their wedding.
Oh, that's right. Congratulations to all those folks. Mike, thanks for joining us.